We continue our series on the book of Esther. I'm going to actually begin the last verse of chapter 5. Our text will be the entirety of chapter 6. Then said Zeresh, his wife, this is Haman's wife, and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak thou unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. On that night could not the king sleep, and he commanded to bring the book of records of the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigtana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door, who sought to lay a hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor and dignity hath been done to Mordecai for this? Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, there is nothing done for him. And the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman was come into the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's servant said unto him, behold, Haman standeth in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said unto him, what shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, to whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself? And Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let the royal apparel be brought which the king useth to wear, and the horse that the king rideth upon, and the crown royal which was set upon his head, and let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man with all whom the king delighteth to honor, and bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. Then the king said to Haman, make haste, and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew, that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken. Then took Haman the apparel and the horse, and arrayed Mordecai, and brought him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor. And Mordecai came again to the king's gate, but Haman hasted to his house mourning and having his head covered. And Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, unto him, if Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shalt surely fall before him. And while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hasted to bring Haman unto the banquet that Esther had prepared. Beloved of God, the Jews, the people of God, are in grave danger. Haman, the Amalekite descendant of Agag, king of the Amalekites, avowed enemies of the Jews, has used his position as second in command of all Persia to plot the destruction of the people of God throughout the world. The law of the Medes and the Persians now is that in a few months, the Jews shall be eradicated from the earth. This matters not just to the Jews, this matters to you, and it matters to me seated here this evening. The Lord Christ is in the womb of the church of these Jews. The gospel is in jeopardy. This matters to you and to me because God has promised to preserve his church. The promises of God are in jeopardy here. This matters to you and to me because the covenant of God is an everlasting covenant, and his covenant is in jeopardy here. Besides the danger that the Jews generally are in, we've learned at the end of the last chapter that Mordecai, in particular, is himself in grave danger. Last night, Haman came home to his wife and friends on top of the world. Second in command of Persia, all wealth he could possibly imagine. And besides that, he had been invited to an exclusive banquet, just himself, the king, and the queen. And now another one, the next night, too. But then as he walked out of that banquet last night, he came upon Mordecai, who again refused to bow to him, and his anger, his bitterness, rose up. And at the instigation of his wife, to whom he told these things, Haman plotted the death of Mordecai the Jew. Get up early tomorrow morning. Through the night, have your men make a gallows for you, high gallows, 75 feet high. And in the morning, go to the king's palace and ask if you can kill Mordecai upon those gallows. Surely he will let you. There's danger. Of the danger of the Jews generally, Mordecai is aware, and now Esther herself is aware as well. Of Haman's plot against Mordecai himself personally, neither Mordecai nor Esther knew anything about this. So though Esther will be herself involved as a tool of the hand in the hand of God to preserve his people and his covenant and to deliver the Jews, there must now be more than simply Esther to deal with Haman. Mordecai had said to Esther before that if she does not take up her charge in this position that she has been put in, then deliverance shall arise from another place. Well, the whole point, beloved, of Esther chapter 6 is that even if Esther does take up her charge, which she does, deliverance must still arise from another place. Chapter 6 is the hinge of the whole book of Esther. It is right here, Esther chapter 6, that the great turn, the great reversal begins to take place. The danger begins to be averted for God's people. Judgment begins to fall upon the heads of the enemies of the church, and significantly, it happens while Esther is sleeping. And while Mordecai is sleeping, but while the God of all the earth, who neither slumbers nor sleeps, is wide awake. Psalm 68, verse 1 reads, "Let God arise, let his enemies be scattered. Let them also that hate him flee before him." God is arising here in Esther chapter 6 to defend his people, to defend his covenant, to defend his promises, and the anointed one who is coming. But it looks a little bit different. Sometimes when God arises to come to the aid of his church, a Red Sea parts and then comes crashing down upon enemies. Sometimes frogs take over the land and lice and flies and locusts. And sometimes when God arises, it's much more subdued, but no less wonderful. And a king can't seem to fall asleep. A sleepless king is the theme of the sermon tonight. Let's notice first God's work. Second, the beginning of a great reversal. And third, let's focus on the man whom the king delights to honor. Beloved of God, we live in a world where the message of the book of Esther is so appropriate and so needed. In the book of Esther, God is so obviously present, working in the history of the world to preserve his covenant and church. And yet, no one acknowledges it out loud. Almost awkwardly so, no one seems to acknowledge his presence or his work. His name isn't mentioned by anyone, even in times when it seems so obvious that it would be. It's held back. So too, in the day and age in which we live, through the advances of science, we've uncovered the complexity of this creation. In cells, in atoms, in the vast expanses of the universe, galaxies and black holes. And all of it shows forth the power and majesty of God and his creativity. We see it like we never saw it before. And all of it has his fingerprints all over it. And yet, somehow we're supposed to just ignore that this is him, that he has done this, and not mention his name in the textbooks of this land or speak of him in the public square. His judgments fall upon a world of men who rebel against him. Natural disasters increase. Even the world sees and comments on the fact that natural disasters are increasing. And yet, we're not supposed to say anything. We're just supposed to keep quiet and not mention the fact that he's the one who sends these things, that they're footsteps of the coming of Christ, and that they have something to say about the sin and rebellion of mankind. History reveals the preservation of God's church. Then and now, his church stands against the rage that she has endured for ages upon ages. And yet we're somehow supposed to cleanse our history books and history courses of his presence, of his sovereign providential hand over all of it, of his involvement in every last detail, not mention his name, that he's so obviously there, acting, working. C.S. Lewis once said, "A man can no more diminish God's glory by refusing to worship him than a lunatic can put out the sun by scribbling the word darkness on the walls of his cell." And yet men keep trying. And the message of the book of Esther is that try as you might to ignore him, try as you might to think that he's not there acting and working, it doesn't mean he's gone. It doesn't mean that he isn't. He's there. You can't blot him out. And in chapter 6, that message preaches in its loudest decibels. In this Persian court that has suppressed the truth and worshipped idols, with the people who are under his banner, called by his name, who are supposed to be in Jerusalem anyway, worshiping him at his temple, and who can't seem to speak his name with conviction. Yet he's still here. Yet he's so obviously here and working, preserving, protecting, guarding his church, his covenant, and his Christ in every tiny, little, otherwise insignificant event. On that night, the king could not sleep. On that night, that particular night, Ahasuerus could not sleep. What was it on that night? Did he eat too much at Esther's banquet? Indigestion? Was his mind racing? Was he trying to figure out, why did she risk her life to ask me something? She won't tell me. What is it? Was it nothing that he was aware of? He couldn't himself put his finger on. He just couldn't sleep. whatever it was, when the psalmist could not sleep, he confessed, "Thou holdest my eyes waking. Thou art the God over all and over sleep too." And though Ahasuerus wouldn't have confessed that, it's true enough here too. God kept the king from sleeping. God kept the king from sleeping that night, in particular this night. The night when Haman's men are building the gallows to crucify Mordecai thereon. That night, the night after the first banquet and before the second banquet. That night is the night right before Esther is going to make known her request to the king, not knowing exactly how he's going to respond to it. That night, God would take care of how the king would respond to it. It has to be this night that the king won't sleep. His timing is perfect, God's. He knows what he's doing, even if we can't understand and don't see. He's working. He's working when we're sleeping. It's been decreed from all eternity that this particular night, Ahasuerus would not be able to sleep. And now as this night unfolds in time, the same God, Ephesians 1, verse 11, who works all things after the counsel of his will, carries out what has been determined. And because the king can't sleep, it sets in motion events that will lead to the rescue of the church, that affect the way Ahasuerus will respond to Esther's request and preserve the covenant of God. The king can't sleep. And so he tries to find something that will put him to sleep. What do you do when you can't sleep? What I do is I try to find the most boring book that I have, and I read it, hoping that the fact that it's boring will eventually put me to sleep. That's precisely what Ahasuerus does. He tries to find the most boring thing he can possibly think of to be read to him, and he calls his servants to read it to him. And the most boring thing he could possibly think of is the Chronicles of the Empire. It reads like a minute book. It almost reads like a phone book. It reads like this. March 30, 9 a.m., tax contributions were received from the 36th quadrant. 9:10 a.m., Bildad enters to report on the harvest in Moab. And on it drones. But then Ahasuerus has the problem, maybe you have, I have too. Even the most boring thing turns out to be fairly interesting. The servant reads something that strikes the king, and he wakes up wider than he'd been before. A report, 9:36, Mordecai, a Jew, enters and reports that Bigtana and Teresh are plotting to assassinate the king. And the king says, "What? Go to the next page. What happened?" It was decided an investigation will be entered into Bigtana and Teresh. And what happened? Keep going. The investigators report they were planning an assassination of the king. And they were hung on the gallows to preserve the king's life. And the king, wide awake now. Mordecai, a Jew, uncovered this plot against... When he had heard of this first, yeah, the name was mentioned, but it didn't mean anything to him. Mordecai, the Jew, comes in. A Jew? Mordecai's a Jew? Mordecai, the Jew, uncovered this? Did anything happen to him? Did we reward him for this? And the men turn a few pages later, the records, nothing, no. This event had occurred 5 years earlier. We were told about it, remember, at the end of chapter 2. And we were even told there that it had been written down back then 5 years ago in the Chronicles of the Empire, Esther 2, verse 23. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. And now this night, of all nights, you understand, the king just happens to not be able to sleep. And it just so happens that instead of calling for one of his hundreds, if not thousands, of concubines to come in, instead of going downstairs to make himself a sandwich, he calls for the Chronicles of the Empire to be read to him, and it just so happens that the servant pulls the book of Chronicles from 5 years back off the shelf. And it just so happens that he flips open to the day when Mordecai uncovered the plot against the king's life. And then it just so happened that very early that same morning, now after the night is starting to turn to day, that Haman, who wants to kill this same Mordecai, has come now into the king's court to ask the king permission to hang him upon a tree. And it just so happens that King Ahasuerus has a personality, as we've been discovering through this book. He has a personality that he won't make any decisions on his own without advisors. And so he asks when he hears that Mordecai has not been rewarded at all, nothing's been done to thank him for saving the king's life. Are there any of my advisors here? Is anybody in the court at all? Someone who I can ask what I should do about this? And it just so happens that Haman has now come in to the court, the only one of the advisors ready to get an early start because he has a request. And the king said, verses 4 and 5, who is in the court? And he's asking, who can I seek advice from? Now Haman was come into the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king, to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's servant said unto him, behold, Haman standeth in the court. And the king said, let him come in. And it just so happened that when the king asks for Haman's advice about honoring this person, he leaves out the name. Just like Haman conveniently left out who it was that he wanted to kill off in the empire earlier, who genocide would be ordered against. And he just asks, who is the man? What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? Haman, filled with pride, thinks it's himself, of course. And it just so happened that Esther thought it was wise to pique the king's interest and to wait, not the first night, but the second night, the second banquet, to ask the king her request. And it just so happened that Mordecai was overlooked when he brought that plot to the king and was not rewarded as he should have been. And it just so happened that Zeresh had given advice to her husband that he ought to go in the morning and seek permission to kill Mordecai. And it just so happened that Vashti had gotten lippy when she did, that started this whole process in the beginning. And it just so happens that this is your God. Who has controlled every detail of your life. To be your God and to preserve you as his child. And every detail of what's not your life. To be your God and to preserve you as his child. Have you ever thought about the trillions upon trillions of things that had to be moments in succession connected to each other all over the world and the history of this globe for you to end up in this chair this evening confessing the name of this God and trust in the providence of this God? I recently came across a book that allowed me to trace my ancestry on my father's side. And by the time I was finished reading it, I was in tears and in awe, filled with worship, as it became clear to me that if Napoleon had not tried to take over the world, I would not be here right now. Likely would have been somewhere in an atheist, secularist household, like the vast majority in the European nation. He's controlled every minute detail of the history of this world to ensure that you would be gathered into his body and bride, and that you would live right now in this place. And he will control every single moment from here on out to ensure that what he started with you, he will complete and will not abandon. How blessed you must be to have this God as your God. Happy is that people that is in such a case. Yea, happy is that people whose God is the Lord. Absolutely, yes, beloved. Esther has a responsibility here. Yes, as we saw last time, she has a calling here that is placed upon her before the King Ahasuerus. Yes, she has been put into the kingdom for such a time as this. And yes, you and I are responsible. And yes, you and I have callings. And yes, we have been put into the kingdom for such a time as this. And they matter. The carrying out of them matters. It's part of his providence that he grants us, that he raises us up. It gives us these callings. It's part of his work. But as we move from 5 to 6, the message is now that ultimately it's not you or I who save, preserve, strengthen, build up his church, his kingdom by our callings. Just as it is not Esther who saves Israel, and it is not Mordecai who saves Israel, but it is God. That's what Esther 6 is telling us. That's why this happens at night when everybody else is sleeping. That's why the hinge of the story of the book of Esther is not Esther at the first banquet, and it's not Esther at the second banquet, but it's in the dead of night, where God, as it were, without means, is reaching down from heaven and holding the eyelids of a king open. Esther 6 is not likely the first place you would turn to establish the need for our own Christian schools. But Esther 6 screams this. Because we're taught by Esther chapter 6 how to understand history, how to understand secular history, and how to teach all history, including secular history. To see that all of it, big things and little things, is God gathering, preserving, defending his church, that it's him unfolding and keeping his covenant. That all history, including secular history, is covenant history. Esther 6 cries aloud that all history must be taught this way, that God's children must see this, that God is working, that he's active in every detail and every corner of this globe, and that even if the history teacher can't take every single individual event and tie it to God's covenant purposes, but the ones that he can, he does. And the ones that he can't, he still says, that line is there. That line is there, and you must know it's there, child. How many Christian schools even get this anymore? The covenant is everything, and the God of the covenant is everything. And all history is God doing this thing. Children, regeneration and calling and faith don't just save you, they also make you smart. The greatest intellect in all the world remains a fool if he can't see this in his study of the history of the world. He fails to see God and his covenant and his purposes happening in every event, in every corner. He's blind, How dare we give our children over to those who scribble darkness all over the wall of the children's minds, even as the sun is shining bright through the material that they are studying? Though it costs thousands and thousands upon thousands, they must see him. They must see him. They must see him in the bedroom of a Persian king at night in 470 BC. They must see him in a jeep in Sarajevo in 1914, where a confused driver takes a left turn instead of a right turn and starts World War I. They must see him in the flu bug that entered the home and the lungs of one Reverend M. Gritters, changing the course of ecclesial history in 1951 for the side of a right understanding of this covenant of God. They must see the God of history arise, arise in the big things and all the little things governed by his providence. The door that is swinging on the hinge of this providence of God governing all of these details is, as I said, the preservation of his covenant, his church, his promises, and his anointed one. This is the beginning, as I said in the introduction, of the great reversal in the book. The door that seemed to be so wide open to destroy the church, to destroy the promises of God, to destroy his covenant, to prevent the coming of his Messiah, is being closed right here. And instead, a great reversal. God's people will be exalted, and the enemies of his people and his covenant will be cast down. And this is played out first in Haman and in Mordecai. Haman representing as a picture of the Antichrist himself, the enemies of God's church and his covenant, and Mordecai, the people under the banner of Christ. Whereas at the end of chapter 2 and in the first part of chapter 3, Haman is exalted and Mordecai is passed by, though he's uncovered a plot of the king. And then at the end of chapter 5, it seems that Haman has all power. It could go no higher. And the death of the Jews and of Mordecai is assured. Now, great reversal. Mordecai is exalted, and Haman will be brought low. And the king said unto him, "What shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "To whom would the king delight to honor more than to myself?" If there's any proof needed that pride is blinding, there it is. Of course, he's thinking of me. I don't even have to ask if he's thinking of me. Of course, it's me. And so Haman in his pride throws all sense of modesty to the wind and says, "Let's let it loose. For the man whom the king delights to honor, let the royal apparel be brought out that the king used to wear, and the horse that the king rides upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head. And let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man with all whom the king delights to honor, and bring him on horseback through the streets of the city, and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" And can you imagine, beloved, you can only imagine the look on Haman's face when the king responds, "Make haste, take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew." What? And he has to try to hold it together before the face of the king, but can he stop the sinking feeling coming out in the eyes and upon the face? And then he has to do it. It's the king's commandment. He has to dress up Mordecai himself personally because that's what he had said. And he has to take the horse and he has to lead Mordecai around the city himself. And he has to stand out front and cry out, "Thus shall it be done to the man the king delights to honor." And the whole time, he wants to crawl in a hole. He's trying to cover his face as he leads the horse along. Haman hasted to his house, mourning and having his head covered. Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, "Let us break their bands asunder and cast their cords from us." But he that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Here is one fulfillment of that text. And every time the enemies of God's church arise and seek the destruction of God's people and of his cause, of his purposes, of his kingdom and his covenant, God produces a great reversal and overthrows their plans and keeps his promises, accomplishes his covenant, fulfills his purposes. There are fulfillments of that verse from Psalm chapter 2. But we have to remember, beloved, that ultimately it's a text that finds its greatest fulfillment in the greatest reversal on a hill outside of Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, where the Savior, who claimed to be the fulfillment of God's promises in himself, who claimed to be the beloved Son of God, who claimed to be the covenant in our flesh, was despised and rejected, suffered innumerable reproaches, was brought low, so that whereas Mordecai was dressed in royal robes and was honored and led throughout the city in his glory and might, God's son was dressed in mock robes and spit upon and beaten. Whereas Mordecai was mounted on a great white steed, he was mounted upon a donkey. Whereas Mordecai was given the king's crown to wear himself, the Christ wore a crown of thorns. Whereas Mordecai heard the voice, "Here is the man whom the king delights to honor." The Christ heard these voices, "You think you are the Son of God? Then come down. He's cursing you. He's rejecting you. You are nothing." And yet, when the enemies had him doomed to destruction, when the devil had the gallows built upon which he would be hung, and got farther than Haman ever got, had him hanging upon those gallows between heaven and earth, a sign of curse, the people rejected him. It seemed God had rejected him. The church had rejected him. The devil, his hosts, all that dominion had conquered, so it seemed, the hopes of God's covenant that lived in him destroyed, the great head and surety of that covenant brought to a bloody end and a great reversal. The cross becomes hope and not shame, glory and not despising. The very foundation of that covenant established in him, that what was supposed to destroy it, make it null and void, in fact, was the foundation of it, a sacrifice, an offering given, an atonement for the sins of the citizens of the kingdom, of the members of that covenant. The promises of God established as yea and amen in him. And on the third day, the great reversal, not death, but life. And the 40th day, up to the right hand of God himself, the cross, merely the means, the way to such exaltation, so that looking back, the devil and all of his anti-Christian host were able to see that unwittingly, God the King made them lead him into his glory, as it were, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man the King delights to honor." And oh, the details, beloved, the details. Oh, the details the God of providence was working out even so far away, where men scribbled darkness to try to blot out the sun. The details way back in this Persian Empire to adopt crucifixion and to bring it to the Romans. The details here in the sleepless night in the king's bedroom, and all the details later in the room of another king, a Roman king, where there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. In this greatest reversal, you have yours and I have mine. Not merely now the physical protection of his people, though that's a glorious thing, but her spiritual protection made possible by this very great reversal that led to the coming of Jesus Christ. What great reversal has he done for you? You can recount many, I assume, but this, the greatest of them all, that in the fall of Adam you were doomed to destruction. You're dead, you're cursed. The blade hanging over your head. The devil had seeming victory in your life and over your soul. But in Christ, the dead were given life, the cursed, blessed, dressed in the robes, the royal robes of the King himself in the Holy Gospel. So that you see, people of God, when the greatest Haman arises upon the scene, which is coming, and God's people are chased to the ends of the earth, don't forget the book of Esther and its great reversal. And don't forget the Christ and his greatest reversal. And don't forget your own life and the great reversal there. And don't forget that this is a pattern, because Jehovah is a God of great reversals. That this says something about who he is. He is a redeeming God, that he delights before the face of his people to make himself shine in the deliverances of his church, to draw out of destruction into glory. And that even then, the great reversal will come. As promised, it will come. The Christ and the clouds of glory will come to a church so beleaguered, made the offscouring of the earth, brought low before the eyes of all the world, and he will exalt her, reverse her, and lift her up to the highest heights in the highest heavens. Do you think, beloved, that the world deep down even knows that this is how it's going to end? And do you think, beloved, that even the Antichrist, when he comes, and the people around him will know deep down that this is how it's going to end? When Haman gets home after exalting Mordecai, he comes back to talk to his wife, Zeresh, and his friends, advisors, and he recounts everything that happened and how just the moment when it seemed he had Mordecai in his grip, This reversal took place, and he himself had to exalt Mordecai, lift Mordecai up even higher than he was himself in the kingdom. And his wife and his counselors hear about this, and they respond to Haman the exact opposite way of the way they talked to him the night before. Last night they told Haman, "Your star is rising, Haman. Go out, build the gallows for Mordecai. March in to the king and ask him for Mordecai's life. Get your revenge." And now notice what Zeresh says when Haman comes home, hiding his face in shame. Verse 13. And Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had befallen him. And then said his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, unto him, "If Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews, before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shalt surely fall before him." One of the most fascinating verses in the book of Esther. If Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews, before whom thou hast begun to fall, then you're not going to prevail, Haman. You're going to be destroyed. This is not the first time that Zeresh knows that Mordecai is a Jew. And that's not the great reason for the difference. Last night, when Haman talked to his wife, bragging himself up, but then speaking about that Mordecai who wouldn't bow to him, Haman had told her that Mordecai was a Jew. Verse 13 of the previous chapter. "Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." It's not now that she's just learning that Mordecai is a Jew and she's saying, "Oh, if you would have told me that he was a Jew, then I would have given you different advice. God is on his side." But the key here is the phrase, "before whom thou hast begun to fall." If Mordecai is of the people of the Jews, and you have now begun to fall to him, this isn't going to end well. Zeresh knew the history. She knew the history of the Jews and of the Amalekites. She knew the history of Saul and King Agag. She knew the history. She knew how God preserved his people before the Amalekites, holding up Moses' arms and winning the battle. And as soon as it was evident to her that God had arisen to the defense of his people, she knew there's nothing that could be done. Haman will be destroyed. And what Haman reports to her is just too ironic. It's too ironic to not be the finger of God stepping in. He won't stop until you're destroyed altogether. She's forced to acknowledge the power and faithfulness of God. On that day, beloved, every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Even the wicked and unrepentant, through gritted teeth, will acknowledge it. They'll say it. Though throughout history they seek the destruction of the work of God, they will be forced to acknowledge that it is indestructible, that they cannot prevail, we're not able to prevail. Will there be someone who finally tells that last Haman at the end, when his vast worldwide kingdom begins to break apart, and he sees that everything is crumbling around him, is there going to be someone who tells that final last Haman, "If this Christ that you are the antithesis of be the seed so long promised, and his people, his seed in him, before whom thou art now beginning to fall, then you shall not prevail, but shall surely be destroyed before him." On that day, even that Haman will be forced to say it, and to say it concerning the Christ that he has been anti of, whom he has sought the place of. "Thus and is glorious. He comes to destroy him himself. Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Are you honoring him? In every aspect of your life, bow to him. Lead him, as it were, throughout the city of your life. This is the man whom the king delights to honor, whom I delight to honor, to praise, worship, adore. It's the only way. It's the only way that the comfort and the protection of the God who controls all of the details of the history of the world in his providence for his people, for his church, for his covenant is known to be yours. Oh, how Haman hated the thought of Mordecai exalted in glory, the king's crown, the king's robe, and on the king's horse. The praise and the exaltation going to that man and not himself. Oh, how he hated that Mordecai was the man the king delighted to honor. And oh, how there's such a tendency in the world of men and still hiding in our old man of sin that wants a religion where it's not about him, first of all, but where it's about me. Where it's not about him crowned and glorified, but it's about me crowned and glorified first. Who's on the horse in your religion? This is why there's ever the tendency to switch the order around in your heart and in mind and every corruption of the truth of God's word. I am the one whom the king delights to honor first. If there's anything to do with Christ, Christ gets the glory by riding in my wake, you know. It's all about me, first of all, me. Christ only exists for me. I don't exist for him. He bows to me. He's here for me. He belongs to me. It's not like what we heard this morning, that I belong to him. He belongs to me. And therefore, I don't really need to obey him so much. It's all about me in the end anyway. His law, what does that mean? It's about me. Who's on the horse in your religion? You have a problem with Christ being the man the king delights to honor first of all? Above and beyond you? An issue with the preservation of his covenant and his working in all of the details of the history of this world? First for the king of that covenant, for the head of that covenant, and the glory of the one arrayed in royal robes with a crown upon his head. Why the fall? So that he could come. Why enemies to defeat? So that he is exalted. Do you have an issue with the fact that when God arises and his enemies are scattered, that first it's for the exaltation of his Son and his majesty and his mercy? And that you are only exalted in him. Bow to that. The bride eyes not her garment. but her dear bridegroom's face. I gaze not at my glory, but on the King of grace. Not at the crown he giveth, but on his pierced hand. The Lamb is all the glory of Emmanuel's land. It's Christ. And it's only me in him. It's only me in his wake. But yes, in his wake. Could not the Jews sense something of their great reversal? And the great reversal for Mordecai? Ahasuerus knows full well that Mordecai is a Jew. Then the king said to Haman, make haste and take the apparel and the horse as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken. And obviously by this point the king is aware that the people group whose genocide he authorized is the Jews. It's been plastered all over the kingdom now. It's been written. And yet he honors this Jew whom he realizes had once saved his own life. And the Jews see it. They see it. It's public. He takes him before all the people through the city. And the Jews of Shushan are part of those who bow down as Mordecai, one of their own, comes passing by. And they see and they know something is going on here. There's an exaltation of their hope in the exaltation of Mordecai. And we bow as God exalts his son, as he lifts him high, as he has him arrayed in royal robes, places his own crown upon his head in his resurrection, his ascension, and his seating at the right hand, knowing as we bow full well that one of our own has been brought into that glory. In his wake, I will go with him. All this, beloved, because one night, that night, the king couldn't sleep. Amen. Father in heaven, bless thy word to our hearing. Grant faith and hope and trust. In Jesus' name, amen.